English Listening Comprehension Test, Autumn 2010, Advanced Level. This test is in four parts. Part 4 has separate directions. In Parts 1, 2, and 3, you will answer the questions asked in the booklet by choosing the best alternative answer according to what you have heard. Mark each answer on the optical answer sheet. The test is about to begin. Now you will hear Part 1 twice. First, listen to it straight through.
Hello! You're going to hear a talk by Matthew Crawford. Matthew has been asked by your school principal to talk about one aspect of education that is often overlooked in our modern societies, the aspect of the education of our hands.
Good morning. We know there are lots of TV shows about working with your hands. For example, Deadliest Catch is about commercial crab fishermen in the Bering Sea. Dirty Jobs shows all kinds of backbreaking labor, like working on a dairy farm or in a steel mill. Many of us do work that feels more unreal than real. The modern office is full of cubicles. They look like little boxes with workers in them. People in an office often find it difficult to see any concrete result from their efforts. Quite a few cartoons show the ridiculous life in the office cubicle. They witness to the dark satire with which many Americans have come to view their white-collar jobs. In the 1990s, many high school vocational and trade programs were stopped. Educators were preparing students to become knowledge workers. In the last 20 years, it was considered necessary to round up every warm body and send it to college, and then to the cubicle. This was tied to the vision that we somehow escape material reality and glide about in a pure information economy. This has not come to pass. Fundamentally, now as ever, somebody actually has to do things. Fix cars, wash floors, wait on tables. In the 90s, vocational programs of all types were forcibly moved from the schools and into the junior colleges. This meant that students were 18 years old before they had an opportunity to start to learn a trade. You know, hairdressing, anything. Yet children and youth were expected to just sit in school for 13 years and take pills, so they wouldn't jump around or start doing something with their hands. So they'd be calm and concentrate on their socially oriented schoolwork. So they'd fit into life in the office cubicles. After I earned a master's degree in the early 1990s, I went to work writing summaries of academic journal articles. When I got the phone call offering me that job, I was excited. I had made it into the modern knowledge economy. But the feel of the job changed on my first day. I was expected to write summaries, that is, abstracts of scientific and academic articles, on fields understood only by experts. On classical philology, where every other word was Greek. On nature genetics. The company which hired me had an official ideology. There is a method for writing an abstract, and it can be applied without understanding the subject matter of the article. And there were quotas. At first, every single day I wrote 15 summaries for 15 articles. After a few months, I was up to 28 articles a day. On paper, my abstracting job looked attractive. I was doing something my unschooled parents couldn't even imagine, much less understand. Yet my master's degree hid that this was a very stupid job. Before I started my university studies, I'd been a proudly self-employed electrician. As an electrician, I had felt tested and stimulated rather than bored and numb. I had to make a decision. I thought the answer to my dilemma was more education. I got my doctorate in political philosophy from the University of Chicago in 2000. But at that time, the academic job market was bleak. In a state of professional panic, I retreated to a workshop in the basement of my apartment building. There I spent the winter tearing down my old Honda motorcycle and rebuilding it. It was so physical. It was so specific. Then I found my dream job, executive director of a policy organization in Washington, D.C. But it sometimes required me to take positions I wasn't completely comfortable with. After 5 months at this think tank, I'd saved enough money to buy some tools I needed. I quit and went into business fixing bikes. I tend to work pretty slowly. Motorcycle repairs are... Well, in fixing motorcycles, you come up with several imagined trains of cause and effect. You judge their likelihood before tearing anything down. If the motorcycle is 30 years old, from an obscure maker that went out of business 20 years ago, its tendencies are known mostly through the folklore. So you have to be well acquainted with a community of mechanic antiquarians. You see, the repair manuals aren't any help. And you, the mechanic, are ultimately responsible to the motorcycle and its owner, not the manual. And that's the real joy of working with your hands.
Now listen to the same talk in five sections. Look at questions 1 and 2.
Hello! You're going to hear a talk by Matthew Crawford. Matthew has been asked by your school principal to talk about one aspect of education that is often overlooked in our modern societies, the aspect of the education of our hands.
Good morning. We know there are lots of TV shows about working with your hands. For example, Deadliest Catch is about commercial crab fishermen in the Bering Sea. Dirty Jobs shows all kinds of backbreaking labor, like working on a dairy farm or in a steel mill. Many of us do work that feels more unreal than real. The modern office is full of cubicles. They look like little boxes with workers in them. People in an office often find it difficult to see any concrete result from their efforts. Quite a few cartoons show the ridiculous life in the office cubicle. They witness to the dark satire with which many Americans have come to view their white-collar jobs.
Answer questions 1 and 2, then look at questions 3 and 4.
In the 1990s, many high school vocational and trade programs were stopped. Educators were preparing students to become knowledge workers. In the last 20 years, it was considered necessary to round up every warm body and send it to college, and then to the cubicle. This was tied to the vision that we somehow escape material reality and glide about in a pure information economy. This has not come to pass. Fundamentally, now as ever, somebody actually has to do things. Fix cars, wash floors, wait on tables. In the 90s, vocational programs of all types were forcibly moved from the schools and into the junior colleges. This meant that students were 18 years old before they had an opportunity to start to learn a trade. You know, hairdressing, anything. Yet children and youth were expected to just sit in school for 13 years and take pills, so they wouldn't jump around or start doing something with their hands. So they'd be calm and concentrate on their socially oriented schoolwork. So they'd fit into life in the office cubicles.
Answer questions 3 and 4. Look at questions 5 and 6.
After I earned a master's degree in the early 1990s, I went to work writing summaries of academic journal articles. When I got the phone call offering me that job, I was excited. I had made it into the modern knowledge economy. But the feel of the job changed on my first day. I was expected to write summaries, that is, abstracts of scientific and academic articles, on fields understood only by experts. On classical philology, where every other word was Greek. On nature genetics. The company which hired me had an official ideology. There is a method for writing an abstract, and it can be applied without understanding the subject matter of the article. And there were quotas. At first, every single day I wrote 15 summaries for 15 articles. After a few months, I was up to 28 articles a day.
Answer questions 5 and 6, then look at questions 7 and 8.
On paper, my abstracting job looked attractive. I was doing something my unschooled parents couldn't even imagine, much less understand. Yet my master's degree hid that this was a very stupid job. Before I started my university studies, I'd been a proudly self-employed electrician. As an electrician, I had felt tested and stimulated rather than bored and numb. I had to make a decision. I thought the answer to my dilemma was more education. I got my doctorate in political philosophy from the University of Chicago in 2000. But at that time, the academic job market was bleak. In a state of professional panic, I retreated to a workshop in the basement of my apartment building. There I spent the winter tearing down my old Honda motorcycle and rebuilding it. It was so physical. It was so specific.
Answer questions 7 and 8. Look at questions 9 and 10.
Then I found my dream job, executive director of a policy organization in Washington, D.C. But it sometimes required me to take positions I wasn't completely comfortable with. After 5 months at this think tank, I'd saved enough money to buy some tools I needed. I quit and went into business fixing bikes. I tend to work pretty slowly. Motorcycle repairs are, well, in fixing motorcycles, you come up with several imagined trains of cause and effect. You judge their likelihood before tearing anything down. If the motorcycle is 30 years old, from an obscure maker that went out of business 20 years ago, its tendencies are known mostly through the folklore. So you have to be well acquainted with a community of mechanic antiquarians. You see, the repair manuals aren't any help. And you, the mechanic, are ultimately responsible to the motorcycle and its owner, not the manual. And that's the real joy of working with your hands.
Answer questions 9 and 10. This is the second part of the test. You will hear this part twice. Listen to this part straight through.
We have two young experts here talking to us about Facebook. Anna and Simon, welcome to Radio 4. What would you two say about Facebook and social networking today?
Well, Facebook and social networking are growing fantastically.
But I think there must be something of an upper limit when it comes to what are called social networking websites. It seems that most people I meet who are addicted to such services are still a bit wet behind the ears. Yes, they're addicts.
I understand you, Simon. And even more disturbing is how Facebook has become a storehouse of personal details about those who choose to subscribe to it. You know, as a colleague pointed out to me last week, if some young person is a victim of a crime, it's only a matter of moments before full personal details can be accessed by the media and shared with the world. These details were once things that had to be got from a caring family or friends. Then they filtered out the information. I wish someone would just tell young people that Facebook is not compulsory.
A younger friend said to me this week that the purpose of Facebook was to keep in touch with people you don't want to keep in touch with. It's that egocentric, syrupy romanticism that is so peculiar to the Anglo-Saxon cultures. This oversensitivity dictates that one simply has to have an idea what people one once knew are doing now in tedious detail. This seems to me to contradict all sensible human nature, which for its part dictates that you stay in touch with people you have a genuine interest to delight in.
I agree, and you steer well clear of everyone else.
Anna, why do you think people want to maintain a continuous online presence?
I think there's a shocking assumption that one's own life is of such enormous interest that everyone else must want to know about it. By this I mean the little acts of everyday existence which one doesn't normally remember. And this may all be part of how the celebrity culture influences us. Not to be so down on everything, what do you think of the internet, Simon?
The internet is possibly the greatest invention of my lifetime. Like the printing press, it is also a means of spreading rubbish. In the internet's case, there are no limits to this spread of rubbish. The liberal in me loves this way in which the freedom of speech can be extended and protected by the web through the wild exchange of ideas. It is a force that I am sure will one day make dictatorial totalitarianism impossible. But as with all other freedoms of speech, that of the web is widely misused. But this misuse is the price we have to pay.
Now listen to the same discussion in three sections. Look at questions 11 and 12.
We have two young experts here talking to us about Facebook. Anna and Simon, welcome to Radio 4. What would you two say about Facebook and social networking today?
Well, Facebook and social networking are growing fantastically.
But I think there must be something of an upper limit when it comes to what are called social networking websites. It seems that most people I meet who are addicted to such services are still a bit wet behind the ears. Yes, they're addicts.
I understand you, Simon. And even more disturbing is how Facebook has become a storehouse of personal details about those who choose to subscribe to it. You know, as a colleague pointed out to me last week, if some young person is a victim of a crime, it's only a matter of moments before full personal details can be accessed by the media and shared with the world. These details were once things that had to be got from a caring family or friends. Then they filtered out the information. I wish someone would just tell young people that Facebook is not compulsory.
Answer questions 11 and 12, then look at question 13.
A younger friend said to me this week that the purpose of Facebook was to keep in touch with people you don't want to keep in touch with. It's that egocentric, syrupy romanticism that is so peculiar to the Anglo-Saxon cultures. This oversensitivity dictates that one simply has to have an idea what people one once knew are doing now in tedious detail. This seems to me to contradict all sensible human nature, which for its part dictates that you stay in touch with people you have a genuine interest to delight in.
I agree, and you steer well clear of everyone else.
Answer question 13, then look at questions 14 and 15.
Anna, why do you think people want to maintain a continuous online presence?
I think there's a shocking assumption that one's own life is of such enormous interest that everyone else must want to know about it. By this I mean the little acts of everyday existence which one doesn't normally remember. And this may all be part of how the celebrity culture influences us. Not to be so down on everything, what do you think of the internet, Simon?
The internet is possibly the greatest invention of my lifetime. Like the printing press, it is also a means of spreading rubbish. In the internet's case, there are no limits to this spread of rubbish. The liberal in me loves this way in which the freedom of speech can be extended and protected by the web through the wild exchange of ideas. It is a force that I am sure will one day make dictatorial totalitarianism impossible. But as with all other freedoms of speech, that of the web is widely misused. But this misuse is the price we have to pay.
Answer questions 14 and 15. This is the third part of the test. In this part, you will hear 10 short dialogues. You will hear each of them once only. Look at question 16.
Howdy, Cheryl. How are you?
Fine, thanks. How are you, Charles?
I just had a thought. I thought of indulging in a little dream of mine, and you could help me out.
Depends on what you had in mind.
I thought a little ice cream might just do the trick.
Okay, I'm in. Where do you want to go?
Answer question 16, then look at question 17.
John got a penalty notice last week. It was stuck on the windscreen of his car, which had been parked in a restricted parking area. It was for people who have physical disabilities like John does. The parking warden left a note on his windscreen that said his badge was not displayed in the correct manner.
Well, what was the matter?
Well, after John complained, the council told him his blue disabled badge was the wrong way round. The parking warden would have had to walk around to the driver's side to read the numbers on it.
And John's 76. It's simply disgusting.
Answer question 17. Look at question 18.
Did you hear about the pilot who landed his four-seat airplane on an Illinois golf course?
No, can't say I did.
He landed on the fifth hole, so his 14-year-old son wouldn't be late for a tennis competition. And he's been ordered to pay a $500 fine and perform 60 hours of community service.
Was anyone hurt?
No. No one was injured. Police stopped the man and his son as they were walking to the nearby clubhouse.
Answer question 18, then look at question 19.
Could the news get any worse?
Well, yes, sadly, it just did. Life has apparently got so bad that we've stopped eating strawberries.
Ah, when the clouds part, the grass is dry enough to spread the picnic rug and wasps gear up for an attack. Strawberries are surely the icing on the cake. They are indeed the cornerstone of a quintessential English summer's day.
Yes, but it always bothers me to see big, fat strawberries, and not just in summer. They're fantastically large and fantastically flavourless.
And so the retail analysts tell us that sales of the fruit were down 9.2% last year. By abandoning the strawberry, we might as well have questioned the very nature of British democracy.
Answer question 19. Look at question 20.
What's wrong with our world?
What did you read now?
Well, two Brazilian teenagers were arrested over the weekend. They were plotting to smuggle cell phones into a prison by flying them in with a kite.
And what happened?
According to police, they were arrested late Saturday with a kite and two mobile phones inside a building in Sao Paulo. And then they confessed.
Answer question 20, then look at question 21.
Bit of an odd day yesterday.
Yes, and James was unable to furnish an explanation for his behaviour.
I wonder what was going on.
I haven't the faintest. Maybe we should just ask him.
Answer question 21. Look at question 22.
I read about an emergency services call in Germany.
Some disaster?
No, but a helicopter rescue team was sent out after terrible screams were heard in a German forest. All they found was a man laughing his head off at a new book he was reading. A woman dialed 999 after she thought she could hear someone being tortured in the woods near Elmstein, Germany.
Oh my goodness!
The fellow told police he had gone to the forest to get some peace and quiet.
Answer question 22, then look at question 23.
Remember the hole in Brown Street we saw yesterday?
Yes, I do. That was quite a shock.
As we were walking, we could see what it was. And last night I read that the hole is an optical illusion, a three-dimensional drawing of a canyon. It's an attempt to make careless cyclists hit the brakes rather than ride dangerously and ignore pedestrians.
I'll say. That should do the trick.
The Islington authorities say it's working very well and the situation is much improved.
Answer question 23, look at question 24.
A 16-year-old inmate escaped from a holding cell in the Macomb County Courthouse in Michigan last Friday. He was found an hour later hiding in a judge's car.
You don't say.
Yeah. The judge said he'd been parking his car there for 18 years and never locked it. It's a secure area. He said a county security officer saw a photo of a girl on the ground next to his car and became suspicious.
And there was the teenager.
Yeah. He was just waiting for the judge to drive away.
Answer question 24, then look at question 25.
Have you heard about the man in the hospital in Brighton? He bit into what was supposed to be a cheese and tomato sandwich and was surprised when he tasted something a bit meaty and chewy. And then he looked down and saw a lizard tail sticking out of the side of the sandwich.
Oh my gosh! How did the lizard get there?
Caterers say the reptile must have fallen into the machinery at the factory that prepared the sandwiches for the health authority. And medics have now given the all clear at the hospital. But they've launched an investigation into the snack horror.
Answer question 25. This is the fourth part of the test. It is an interview on the radio. You will hear this twice. First, listen to this straight through.
Welcome to Star Time on Radio WBST in Indianapolis. Today we're talking about Hollywood. Yes, Hollywood. Indianapolis Monthly has a very long and very colorful article emphasizing, well, the many financial faults of one Tracy Anderson. That's the big deal.
Ah, Tracy Anderson, yeah. Tracy's the celebrity trainer to Gwyneth Paltrow and Madonna and other A-list movie stars. And Tracy developed her fitness method, a program that, frankly, emphasizes being skinny, not just fit, right here in Indianapolis, where her reputation made her the go-to fitness trainer for local celebrities.
What about Tracy's personal life? Where did she meet her husband?
In 1993, the summer after she finished high school, Tracy met her future husband, Eric Anderson, on a movie set, a movie about basketball. Then that fall, Tracy enrolled in dance classes in New York City, but gained 40 pounds. To get rid of the weight, she turned to exercise, a heavy aerobics program, coupled with private Pilates classes. And still, she didn't get the results she wanted. The couple married, and Eric bought a four-bedroom home for them. In July 2001, the Andersons opened a gym and dance studio together. It seemed like life was on the right track.
What happened next?
The Andersons began struggling financially. 4 years later, in 2005, a judge ordered the Andersons to pay their first landlord $85,000. The very next day, another judge ordered them to pay $250,000 to their second landlord. That was also for missed rent payments. The same day the second court judgment was issued, Tracy formed a new company with a new business partner, Deanna Grable. The business they opened together, named Urobics, had two locations, Indianapolis and Los Angeles. Then, 2 months after Urobics was formed, Eric and Tracy Anderson filed for bankruptcy.
I understand that Tracy then met Glenn Barber.
When he met Tracy, Barber was a 36-year-old married father of four. He owned an engineering company and was worth about $10 million. Tracy hired Glenn Barber to build an exercise machine for her. Even though Tracy owed Barber tens of thousands of dollars and other people even more, she asked if he would be willing to buy into her business, Urobics. Barber looked over the business plan and decided to invest. Barber told the papers that he immediately knew that Tracy was going to be successful. He felt she had personality. She was spirited and bubbly. The next year, one of the machines Barber built was bought by Madonna. Then another by Gwyneth Paltrow.
How has Tracy gotten away with years of unpaid bills, bankruptcy, and using up a man's fortune and breaking his marriage, only to wind up a highly praised trainer to the stars.
I see two equally depressing reasons. One, Tracy embodies the principle of our day, keeping up appearances at all costs. Her expensive cars, homes, hotel stays, and studio equipment were all part of Tracy's strategy. The other secret behind her astounding career, people, especially actresses, really want to be extremely thin, not just thin. People are just so desperate to be exceedingly thin. That's what's at the bottom of it.
Now listen to the same interview in 5 sections. After each section, you will have time to answer. Then you will go on to the next section. You will write in Finnish or Swedish. You must write your answers on the special answer sheet. Read question A. Question A, listen to this and then answer the question.
Welcome to Star Time on Radio WBST in Indianapolis. Today we're talking about Hollywood. Yes, Hollywood. Indianapolis Monthly has a very long and very colorful article emphasizing, well, the many financial faults of one Tracy Anderson. That's the big deal.
Ah, Tracy Anderson, yeah. Tracy's the celebrity trainer to Gwyneth Paltrow and Madonna and other A-list movie stars. And Tracy developed her fitness method, a program that frankly emphasizes being skinny, not just fit, right here in Indianapolis, where her reputation made her the go-to fitness trainer for local celebrities.
Read question B. Question B, listen to this and then answer the question.
What about Tracy's personal life? Where did she meet her husband?
In 1993, the summer after she finished high school, Tracy met her future husband, Eric Anderson, on a movie set, a movie about basketball. Then that fall, Tracy enrolled in dance classes in New York City, but gained 40 pounds. To get rid of the weight, she turned to exercise, a heavy aerobics program, coupled with private Pilates classes. And still, she didn't get the results she wanted. The couple married, and Eric bought a 4-bedroom home for them. In July 2001, the Andersons opened a gym and dance studio together. It seemed like life was on the right track. Read question C. Question C, listen to this and then answer the question.
What happened next?
The Andersons began struggling financially. 4 years later, in 2005, a judge ordered the Andersons to pay their first landlord $85,000. The very next day, another judge ordered them to pay $250,000 to their second landlord. That was also for missed rent payments. The same day the second court judgment was issued, Tracy formed a new company with a new business partner, Deanna Grable. The business they opened together, named Urobics, had two locations, Indianapolis and Los Angeles. Then, 2 months after Urobics was formed, Eric and Tracy Anderson filed for bankruptcy.
Read question D. Question D. Listen to this and then answer the question.
I understand that Tracy then met Glenn Barber.
When he met Tracy, Barber was a 36-year-old married father of four. He owned an engineering company and was worth about $10 million. Tracy hired Glenn Barber to build an exercise machine for her. Even though Tracy owed Barber tens of thousands of dollars, and other people even more, she asked if he would be willing to buy into her business, Urobics. Barber looked over the business plan and decided to invest. Barber told the papers that he immediately knew that Tracy was going to be successful. He felt she had personality. She was spirited and bubbly. The next year, one of the machines Barber built was bought by Madonna, then another by Gwyneth Paltrow. Read question E. Question E. Listen to this and then answer the question.
How has Tracy gotten away with years of unpaid bills, bankruptcy, and using up a man's fortune and breaking his marriage, only to wind up a highly praised trainer to the stars?
I see two equally depressing reasons. One, Tracy embodies the principle of our day, keeping up appearances at all costs. Her expensive cars, homes, hotel stays, and studio equipment were all part of Tracy's strategy. The other secret behind her astounding career, people, especially actresses, really want to be extremely thin, not just thin. People are just so desperate to be exceedingly thin. That's what's at the bottom of it.
This is the end of the test. You will now have 8 minutes in which to blacken with a pencil the ovals indicating your answers and to check the written answers. Remember to make sure you have written the following information on your answer sheet, your name and number, and the name and number of your school. In addition, make sure that the information needed for the exam has been carefully marked in. Thank you.